Okay, so we will hear now our final presentation for this morning. Dr. Wendy Constantopoulos is an emergency medicine physician at Mass General Hospital, where she also serves as the medical director of the initiative to end slavery at the Division of Global Health and Human Rights. And she will be presenting about sex trafficking of women and girls in three major cities in the U.S.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you for being here so early in the morning. I almost didn't make it. So I'm going to talk a little bit about a research project that we've been conducting at Mass General through the Division of Global Health and the Department of Emergency Medicine, looking at sex trafficking of women. And we've done this research in multiple cities, in nine cities total, three of them being U.S. cities, the other ones being international cities. So I have no disclosures to report today. And I'm going to start out by just defining what sex trafficking means, or the definition that we used of sex trafficking for those who are in the audience who may not know. But sex trafficking is defined as the recruitment, transportation, transferring, harboring, or receiving of an individual, of a person, by means of threat, force, coercion, abduction, fraud, deception, or abuse of power for the purpose of prostitution or pornography or other form of sexual exploitation. And regardless of the mean used, in the case of a person under the age of 18, it would be defined as sex trafficking. So we used a social science case study methodology. We used this because it allowed for more of an inductive or exploratory approach to research, and it allowed us to learn about it in an open manner as opposed to going into it thinking that we knew all the components and thinking that we understood the context in which sex trafficking occurs. We used semi-structured, open-ended interview guide to perform our interviews, and we did this in Los Angeles, New York City, and Boston, all of which are considered port cities. We first identified a subset of anti-trafficking stakeholders working in these communities, in these cities, and then from there we snowballed out to identify other anti-trafficking stakeholders in these communities. We performed key informant interviews. All in all, it turned out to be 69 interviews, and this was from an array of both health and non-health backgrounds. So we did interview law enforcement officials, FBI agents, government officials, social service workers, nurses, doctors. So we broadened our view there. And we did not perform any victim interviews, although in a few cases, some of those people who were now working in the capacity of as a social service provider, they had been at some point, they were survivors, so they had been at some point victims. And then we used in vivo software to perform the qualitative data analysis and attempted to triangulate wherever possible by looking at the literature and documents available. So the concepts that we were looking at in our study that we tried to address through our interview guide were the question of prevalence, composition, so who are the victims, who are the perpetrators, where are they doing their work, what are the mechanisms of recruitment and the mechanisms of control. We also looked at determinants, both social, cultural, and economic determinants that may put women and girls at risk of being trafficked. And we looked at health consequences and the needs of these victims. And then within that, we started to try to understand what the local health system was doing in order to address those needs. What are we currently capable of or currently addressing? And then trying to identify the barriers that are preventing us from addressing this in a more holistic way. So when it comes to prevalence, I think it was pretty much agreed across the board that there was a lack of accurate prevalence estimates. There are a lot of figures out there about how much sex trafficking is in the U.S. and how many people are at risk. And the figures range a fair bit depending on which source you are looking at, which source you're citing. And some of the reasons for that is the difficulty in collecting data on this population. So there, as of this moment, each city has their own sort of ad hoc way of collecting data, but there isn't a centralized data collection and processing center. So there isn't. So everybody in the state of New York does not report to one central agency, and everybody in the state of California does not report to one. So it's really difficult to figure out how many people are out there that have been identified as trafficking. And then there's also the question of, well, how many people are we identifying? Are we identifying 50% of those who are trafficked? Are we identifying 80% of those who are trafficking? Or are we identifying just the tip of the iceberg, which is usually the catchphrase that is used, that, you know, we're potentially only identifying tip of the iceberg because of the clandestine nature of sex trafficking. And then there's also the psychologically manipulative nature of sex trafficking. So many of the victims may not even recognize themselves as being victims. They may not understand that they have been exploited. They may not know to, you know, put the term sex trafficking on what's happening to them. So, and even if they do know, they're not going to come forth with their story necessarily because they're too afraid to come forward. Their families have been threatened. They themselves have been threatened, or they're too ashamed or feel too much guilt. They feel that they had a role to play in what's happened to them. So there's a lot of psychological, a lot of layers to try to remove before we get down to the nitty-gritty. And then there's also contention over the definition of sex trafficking. So there's a lot of confusion between smuggling and trafficking of humans. There's disagreement between when sex work ends and when trafficking begins. And then there's also a lack of recognition of sex trafficking among nationals, so among U.S.-born citizens. This is thought of more as something that occurs with people that are brought over from other countries and not as much recognized that it's happening to our own, you know, U.S.-born children, let's say, and women. So the mechanisms of recruitment, for the most part, it was psychological manipulation. And in some cases, the traffickers were called the master manipulators. So they either used seductive tactics to entice young girls or young women to basically come with them and lure them into a situation where they were now isolated from their families and more at risk of being put out onto the streets. And then the daddy scenario for those kids who, for example, may have ran away from home or may have been thrown out of home, who now are wandering the streets and figuring out where they're going to get their next meal, when they're going to have a bed to sleep in and a blanket to, you know, cover them in the middle of the winter. You know, there's that other tactic that is used for luring them into trafficking. There's also peer recruitment. By female, so female on female recruitment, and a lot of that is the informants felt that a lot of that was mediated by a male pimp, let's say, but there are reports of the females being the pimps or the traffickers themselves. More for foreign-born nationals would be the last three, although it can happen for U.S.-born nationals. So false offers of employment or education, and you decide that you're going to offer somebody, you know, if you come to the United States with me, we'll get married, and I'll make sure that you get an education, and you have a better life, and we'll get you a good job. Or even if we don't get married, you know, I'll get you a job at a nice factory. And then they come here, and you know, they find that has changed, that those are not the real terms of the deal, and they find themselves now being prostituted or trafficked. And then in some of the really impoverished countries, there were reports of women and girls being bought and sold for this purpose, and then they may end up here in the United States, which is a receiving country. And in a few cases, abduction. This was not the majority of the cases in the U.S., although there was one report of an abduction by someone in one of the U.S. cases. mechanisms of control. So the traffickers may use physical violence, so bruising, burns, cigarette burns was very popular, cuts, fractures, strangulations leading to anoxic brain injuries or traumatic brain injuries from being thrown down a flight of stairs or knocked up or whatever. Sexual violence, so rape and gang rape are obviously an issue in this population. We talked a little bit about the psychological manipulation and sort of they're isolated, they're humiliated, they're made to feel that they're less than worthy. And there's also some traumatic bonding going on, so the traffickers are very manipulative in the sense that they will intermix acts of kindness with acts of violence to kind of keep the person bonded in a way to the trafficker, and it's kind of like the Stockholm Syndrome where you're thankful that you're not being killed today. And then intimidation, some people reported that they had heard stories from the victims that, you know, they had been threatened with weapons or that they had been made to witness violence against one of their peers, one of the other girls, and told, you know, this is what's going to happen to you if you do this, if you try to run away or whatever. Coercion and threats, so blackmail can be used. There was one person who reported that she had heard a story about a victim who had been brought over to the United States and then was basically told that if you talk to anybody, that, you know, we'll go back to your village from where you came from and tell everybody what you've become, basically a prostitute. So obviously there's a huge shame around that. And then threats of harm against the family, against peers, and economic dependence. So all their assets, including their legal documents, if they ever had any, are taken away, and their earnings are taken away as well. So what are the social cultural determinants that will make that will increase vulnerability to sex trafficking? And we looked at this from the individual, the family, community level, and the societal level, and broke it down that way. For the individual, the history of child sexual abuse was a big one. Pretty much every single informant that we interviewed mentioned this being high on the list of what makes them. And this may be because they have distorted boundaries, or they're extra hungry for affection. So they might be easily lured by the boyfriend scenario thing. So there are many reasons for that. And then early exposure to violence, so they may have a distorted view of what normalcy is. Lack of education and lack of education, gang and drug involvement, and from the family level, dysfunctional or unstable family life, we can all sort of figure out why that is an issue. Parental involvement with drugs or prostitution, there were a few reports of that. And then on the societal level, it was more this high demand for commercial sex, the glamorization of the pimping industry, and of a very sexualized media. So the health consequences and needs of this population, obviously the physical injuries that we talked about, sexually transmitted infections and their related diseases, the high-risk pregnancies, particularly in the young teenage girls that are being trafficked, or unwanted pregnancies, unsafe abortions, malnutrition, somaticized symptoms such as chronic pain syndromes, headaches, GI distress, abdominal pain. Dental-related diseases or injuries, they may get their teeth knocked out, they don't really go see dentists, substance abuse and the related morbidities, and psychological disorders, which range the gamut from, you know, anxiety, depression, to mind-body dissociation, to suicidality. Access to healthcare. So for the most part, the victims were accessing healthcare in emergency departments. It seemed that whenever they did access healthcare, it had to be something big. It wasn't for preventative care. It was for an actual injury that they needed to seek help for. They also were accessing health services through community health clinics, but the majority went to emergency departments. And then the NGO service providers themselves kind of served as liaisons with for the victims with healthcare services. They tried to get them into healthcare, and many of them felt that these were this was probably one of the difficulty of doing this kind of work, trying to figure out where to send them to get them the help that they needed. And emergency departments were not really felt to be appropriate because they couldn't get comprehensive care, whereas they had to, you know, rely on making phone calls to someone that they knew at Clinic X to get them to see their client. Barriers to healthcare, so there's difficulty of victim identification, as we talked about. Low awareness among healthcare providers, among those that we did interview who had even an inkling of what trafficking was. They all agreed that their peers were not as aware as they were. Lack of guidance and protocols on how to proceed once you do make an identification in a healthcare setting. And then perceived, maybe actual discriminatory attitudes among healthcare providers towards this population. Everybody has their baggage they bring with them to the table. And then victim health seeking behavior. So obviously they're limited to where they can. These victims are limited in the sense of their movement is restricted and they're isolated. So there's very little chance that they're going to be able to go and seek preventative health care. They're not, you know, independent agent sex workers, let's say. They're really being held sort of in a restricted manner. And so they may not seek health care. And health preventative care may not be their priority either. And other logistical barriers like transportation, hours of operation, gang territory lines. So the conclusions are that the local health system response to sex trafficking is weak, reactive, and uncoordinated, and that we have numerous opportunities for increasing the engagement of healthcare in anti-trafficking work. And these are some of the recommendations that came out of the work, so I'll just take 30 seconds to go through this. To frame sex trafficking as a public health and health policy issue, and this may allow us to engage in primary prevention strategies with community service providers that are already doing the work, raising awareness among healthcare and para-healthcare professionals, and collaborate across sectors to develop the protocols that are needed to know how to act once you make an identification and to develop the social service network so that you can make referrals, and then engage in advocacy and policy development. So I'm going to stop right there.
Thank you very much. I'm going to ask our speakers, please, if you can just join me here for the remaining, 10 or so minutes, and I'll open it up, to questions or comments from the audience. Yes, ma'am.
We had two coders independently coding and then coming together and discussing their code.
Yes.
I had a question about the orders. Certainly your presentation raised a lot of questions and answered questions. Has there been any thinking in terms of trying to go to those communities to collect and qualitative data, actually interview some of the women in those communities through a network to
that's a great question. I think that's what we'd like to do. There's obviously some CAPS data, but you know, a lot of the sampling just doesn't get to that level. And I think, you know, especially when you think about Texas, most of the CAPS is built around the children.